Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, join us as we explore heart health and homeopathy, a show co-hosted by Homeopathy World Community founder and homeopath Debbie Brook, with Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go.
Hi, I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community. Today is December 5th, 2012. This is show number 45 with our special co-host, Dr. Adil Kasim, MD, fourth generation homeopath and a guru to me. And I want to say thank you to all of our listeners. I see we have some people in the chat already lined up and waiting to hear what we're going to talk about today. We're going to be discussing answers to the listener questions. We're going to do a little tribute to a master homeopath and following up with part two of breast abscesses after we've been reading our Kent repertory in a continuous study. So welcome, everyone. Welcome, Dr. Adil.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great today and hoping to get out there and get a walk in for my exercise.
Well, I welcome all the viewers today and the listeners. And I thank everyone who listens to our show, gives us feedback. And I believe there were 762 listeners for the last show on 27th of November.
That's true. Probably more by now. That means, folks, we have all of these shows archived. So if you are in clinic or sleeping because it's not the time of day for you to listen, you can tune in and download the show from any of the previous shows. You can listen to them on your mobile device, on your computer, on your iTunes, and you can share them through Twitter, Facebook, or even on your own website. You can post the radio show widget with a specific show that you particularly like and want to inform the people who visit with you. So there's lots of ways that we can share these shows and get the word out about homeopathy and how powerful and beneficial it is to your health.
Yeah. And as always, since past few shows, we are paying tributes to great masters, and today, 5th of December 2012, we are paying tributes to Dr. Timothy Field Allen, who was born on 24th of April 1837, and he died on 5th of December 1902. It's 110 years now. This great stalwart. And this gentleman was born in Westminster, Vermont. And he received his undergraduate education at Amherst College, his medical degree from New York University. And after serving as a surgeon during the Civil War, he returned to New York, where he partnered with Carol Dunham, another good homeopath and a very senior homeopath of his time. Then he studied homeopathy with Dr. P.P. Wells in Brooklyn. In 1871, Dr. Allen was appointed as a professor of Materia Medica at his mother college, that is New York Homeopathic Medical College. And later he served as president from 1882 to 1893. He obtained a $500,000 grant from Roosevelt P. Flower, which was used to build an addition to the college. This later became the Flower Fifth Avenue Hospital. Is it still there?
I do believe so.
Well, so Dr. T.F. Allen was responsible for this building. So while professor and surgeon at New York Ophthalmic Hospital, Dr. Allen was responsible for its conversion to a homeopathic institution. He was also the director of a homeopathic insane asylum in Middletown, New York. Wow, three hospitals to his credit. He also served as a research center for homeopathic treatment of mental diseases, the institute. But the greatest work why we remember this gentleman, Dr. T.F. Allen, is because he compiled the Encyclopedia of Pure Materia Medica. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is a huge, huge task for any single man to accomplish, because it took over 10 years for him to come out with comprehensive record of all the provings of homeopathic remedies, and the volumes were published between 1874 and 1879, hardly within 5 years, and the publications were 5 years, but the research took 10 years. The volume 1 contains remedies from ABs to atropine. That was in 1874 it was published. In volume 2, we have remedies from aurum to cardus. That is 1875. Volume 3, Carlsbad to Quebeba, 1876. Then 7 volumes, Nicotinum to Plumbago to Serpentina, in 1878. Volume number 9, Silesia to Thuja, and volume number 10, Tilia to Zizia, in 1879. So, really, really a great work. It's not so easy as it sounds. It has taken this man 10 years to compile and compendium, and publication took 5 years. Constantine Hering, Carol Dunham, Adolf Lippi, Richard Hughes all contributed to this monumental work. In a later 4-page printing, publishing date unknown, Allen gave the number of symptoms that had been clinically verified by Dunham. Dunham and Timothy Allen were very good friends. The volumes were offered by subscription. 500 subscriptions were obtained and paid in advance to assure each volume's publication. So he really did take pains for the publication of this Encyclopedia of Pure Materia Medica. For each remedy in the encyclopedia, the actual symptoms are preceded by a list of each prover, the dose they took, and the source of reference. Other sources of information, like accidental poisonings, are also included. The incomparable benefit of Allen's work is that the symptoms are recorded in the actual words of the prover. This averts the distortion of philosophical deputies like Kent, Synthesis of the Complete, which fragment symptoms in separate parts and generalize the specific symptoms. As an example, I can give you a famous excerpt from a proving of Agaricus Muscaricus. And the prover, by the name of Krachemariskov, probably a Russian name, Krachemariskov, I don't know, I'm spelling it right or not, but he says, I became so furious that I can hardly be restrained from ripping my vowels, as I fancy the mushroom has ordered me to do so. These are his words. In 1881, Allen published another small booklet, a critical revision of the Encyclopedia of Pure Materia Medica. It was a reprint of 16 pages from the North American Journal of Homeopathy. Now, this small work is an errata for his larger work. It covers revisions to remedies from Agaricus to Karbovich. Dr. Allen published nothing similar for the rest of the remedies in the encyclopedia. Modern homeopaths, even myself, consider Allen's encyclopedia to be a very essential reference guide. This wasn't always the case, however. At the time of its publication, a review in the December 1879 Homeopathic Times described the encyclopedia as Dr. Allen's gigantic and most discreditable fiasco. I don't know how. Yeah, discreditable fiasco. These were the words used by Homeopathic Times. And the review described the work as a mass of trash, of wild vagaries, of symptoms which seem to have been gathered at random from every language under heaven, from every insane asylum in the land.
Which publication are they criticizing?
December 1879, Homeopathic Times.
And they're referring to the collection?
As Dr. Allen's gigantic and most discreditable fiasco.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, I mean, it's sorry to say, though, so, but then every beautiful work does have its own stones pelting, and we have to see the work, not the stones. So Allen supposedly claimed responsibility for all the translations of original German, but in the reviewer's inspection of Nux Formica chapter, several gross translation errors were found. For example, a literal translation of Hahnemann reads, "She regards the present pain as intolerable," and Allen translated as, "The usual pain seems intolerable." So, okay, plus minuses can be there, but then other authors have verified symptoms of Nux Formica because that's being very, very hypersensitive, and it is actually quite true very clinically that patient, usually the usual patient complaining of pain hyper exaggerates it, and we call it the Nux Formica patient as a very hypersensitive patient.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Julian Whiston, who provides a commentary in the Heritage of Homeopathic Literature, believes that the anonymous reviewer was Egbert Guernsey, one of the editors of the journal, and he says, "If you find a simple translation from so important writer as Hahnemann full of errors, what reliance can be placed on any of the editor's work?" So this is another sarcasm on Allen's work, but nonetheless, such sarcasms are bound to come. It has come from another acclaimed homeopath called Guernsey. Dr. Allen not only published this wonderful monumental book, but he also published Ophthalmic Therapeutics in 1874. He also published another book, a very small book, The Symptom Register, in 1880. And actually, this symptom register, he used to write those, he used to record those symptoms in the mental asylum when he used to give patients. He has proved many remedies on the people of mental asylum, and that's why he's got wonderful symptomatology, the sensations of and the sensations as if, which are, I mean, the entire Allen's encyclopedia is abound with sensations as if. They are written in the symptom register. Handbook of Materia Medica and Homeopathic Therapeutics, 1889. He was one of the persons who translated, actually, in 1891, Boninghausen's Therapeutic Pocketbook. He translated it in English.
Dr. Otto, as you're speaking, I have in my hand the handbook, a handbook of Materia Medica and Homeopathic Therapeutics by Dr. Timothy Field Allen, printed in 1889.
Yes.
And so I'm listening to you speak of him and the essence in his book. This is the original.
You're lucky that because very few people do have this book of Handbook of Materia Medica and Homeopathic Therapeutics. I have it also. And
wonderful.
In 1891, he translated again Boninghausen's Therapeutic Pocketbook, as I said. In 1892, a very small book again he has written as compared to his original work of this Materia Medica. He's written a book, A Primer of Materia Medica. I mean, in that book it is written, how do you read his volumes? The 10 volumes which he has published, how do you actually read? How does a reader read? So if you read A Primer of Materia Medica in 1892, you get a glimpse or you get the know-how how to approach that book and how to use it clinically. And last is, for very busy practitioners, he wrote a book very similar to Allen's keynotes. Another Allen, both the surnames are same, but Allen has written, Allen's keynotes are is a small book, a wonderful book on Materia Medica, which we have on our desktops. And a similar book, Dr. T.F. Allen has written, and it is Pocket Characteristics. So, yes, great amount of contribution. Hardly 40 years of his life he has devoted in 10 to 12 years of his actual working, he has given so much to homeopathy. And he has dedicated 40 years of his life to the art and science of homeopathy. His legacy is preserved by continuing reliance on his work, and whatever the people may have contradicted, may have said against him, may have pelted stones against him, well, we take it in our stride that it is there with everyone. Whosoever does good work, why go to Allen? We have recently in our own homeopathic world community got blog posts wherein people who are against homeopathy are trying to malign this. Am I right, Devi?
Absolutely. So I was curious why homeopaths would malign his Dr. Allen's work, homeopaths, not the general public or the medical institute. And considering his background of education and performance and as a surgeon in the war and creating a hospital, I mean, he has contributed so much. How could anybody say something against all of that? And working with the greats, Wells and Dunham, I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, possibly jealousy, because it's not healthy sarcasm. The words used, I have not quoted those words, but the words, I have them in writing. The words used are quite harsh, not healthy criticism, I believe. But then, since it's come from fellow homeopaths, we have to accept them and we have to take them. But still, when we talk of T.F. Allen, we hold his work in great esteem. And in addition to the devotion to homeopathy, Dr. Allen was an accomplished musician and a botanist. He served as organist for several local churches, and he was also on the board of directors for the New York Botanical Gardens. Great similarity to Boninghausen, I believe. Again, a wonderful musician and a botanist, apart from being a lawyer, Boninghausen. Well, so we pay our tributes to Dr. T.F. Allen. It's 110 years, December 5th, 1902. He left this world, and today is December 5th, 2012.
So, and he worked all the way up to, you know, writing all of these publications throughout his life. I mean, he didn't stop working, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, till the last days of his life, he did work upon. And see, even if
we are also practitioners of homeopathy, and since a long time we have been practicing homeopathy, we know how difficult it is to collect. It's a task by itself.
It's very difficult to see your patients, see your clinic, be a surgeon, be an academician at the same time, collect information, gather information, prove drugs. It takes a long, long time. And plus, in addition, everything requires money. But this gentleman, hats off to him, not only could he publish his volumes, but he could garner a huge sum and convert an allopathic institute into a homeopathic one. And till the edifice is still there today, the Fifth Flower Avenue Hospital, I believe, is still there.
So, well, I found out that that it was the center. I'm looking on the website of Arch Care, and what happened was that when New York Medical College moved to Venhalla in 1978, Flower Fifth Avenue Hospital redirected its acute care mission to become a center of diversified health care under the auspices of the Archdiocese of New York. So they are still there, but they have merged with the New York Medical College.
It's quite unfortunate, because his legacy should have been continued, and we could have today a wonderful big homeopathic hospital in place. But anyway, he actually gave to the society what he could in his time, and we salute that.
Absolutely.
So, moving on to the next arena, and these are the question answers. I've got about 3 to 4 questions, and we'll be starting with a very good question from Dr. Siddharth Suri from a place called Solan in Himachal Pradesh, India. And he says, I was reading Allen's keynotes the other day. In the chapter of Lac Defloratum, the author has mentioned American sick headache. What does it signify? Well, my answer is, Siddharth, let us first decipher as to what the author means by the word American. Why has he word? He is an American himself. So what does he mean by the word American? See, in Oriental culture, the latter is synonymous. The word American is synonymous with Westernization, which particularly includes a specific lifestyle and diet, among other things. And it's generally seen, I mean, that is the author's perspective, that such diets, I don't know, Debbie will correct me, have increased salt, carbohydrate and fat, decreased calcium, potassium and magnesium consumption, and the lifestyle, if physical inactivity, sustained mental stress, and increased relative central adiposity and decreased lean body mass. I mean, overall weight may be normal. Overall weight is hardly a fissure, but apple-shaped obesity, I mean the abdomen or the hip is obese. So that is called as central adiposity and decreased lean body mass. The extremities are lean, but the abdomen and the hips are more. So this is called as westernization or American this. Am I right now? Correct me this.
Do we not have a similar around the world since the advent
of... Yeah, it is quite true. But
yeah.
I don't know why he's used the word American Sikh. This is what we signify about the word American. Because
right.
American
well,
Sikh has a headache is a phrase that signifies a chronic, recurrent, periodical migraine. It's chronic, it is mm-hmm. recurrent or periodical, it's a migraine. But that
well,
means intense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm wondering when this was written, what kind of stressors the people were having, for instance, very competitive nature, having to advance in school, parental expectations, and also the change in technology at the time, the industrial age, things like that, concerns about war. I mean, maybe there are a lot of reasons why...
Maybe. But he has specifically written this word. And I believe it... Of course, it's a word American, but then now today, in this period of time, it applies to practically all developed countries and all developing countries because we are all facing the same thing. I mean, if I can talk about in Indian diet, we have lots of, I mean, increased salt, we have high carbohydrate diet, and of course, the drinks and all are, I mean, they have become universal. Probably in that time, he must have thought that it's only Americans who have got increased salt in their diet or carbohydrate and fat who are physically lesser active as compared to other people in the world or who have got sustained mental stress, whatever. But then this is his meaning. So American Sikh headache is a phrase that signifies a chronic recurrent periodical migraine wherein there is intense throbbing frontal pain associated with nausea, vomiting, possibly a transient blindness or photophobia, may or may not be there, all cases, and obstinate constipation subjects. Many people refer to this as gastric headaches also. So you may have
mm-hmm.
obstinate constipation, or you may have got acidity or gastric headache. And in these subjects who are used to above mentioned lifestyle, I would first think of Naxthromica in such cases. But yes, Lagdef or Lagdifloratum is a wonderful remedy for American Sikh headache. I hope I have justified in answering your question.
And the connection between the digestion, the stomach, and the head is so very strong because we now say that the brain, the stomach has brain cells. It is connected like a second brain.
Exactly. Stomach is the mirror of mind also. And for all hyperacidity cases or gastric irritation cases, we first ask them about their mental stress, their lifestyle and their behavior. So, I mean, it's absolutely true. And if you have got acidity, if you've got gastritis, the whole day, the entire mind is on that area. I mean, it's very difficult to work about. Then you've got temper tantrums. Then you are irritable. You shout at people. You can't take life easily. So... Yes, definitely stomach is the mirror of mind, and brain and stomach are intimately connected to each other.
Anybody who takes lots of spicy foods knows. Anybody who gets a headache after eating ice cream, something cold, they realize there's a connection.
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree.
Okay.
The second question is from Dr. Tim Reagan from Topeka, Kansas, USA. Have you been to this place?
No, I haven't. I've only read about Kansas from The Wizard of Oz.
And he asks, is it possible to cure each and every case that goes to a homeopathic practitioner? Is there no such state as incurability? Please opine. Well, Dr. Tim, are you a doctor? I mean, he's not mentioned whether he is a medical doctor or a PhD. But nonetheless, he's a doctor, and
Well, definitely not. Homeopathy can claim to cure only natural cases. Suppose if you're a homeopath, then I should ask you to refer to aphorism number 76, wherein Hahnemann writes, and I quote, "Only for natural diseases has the beneficent deity granted us in homeopathy the means of affording relief. But those devastations and maimings of the human organism, exteriorly and interiorly, effected by years frequently of the unsparing exercises of the false art," by false art he means allopathy, "with its hurtful drugs and treatment, must be remedied by the vital force itself, appropriate aid being given for the eradication of any chronic miasm that may happen to be lurking in the background, if it have not already been too much weakened by such mischievous acts, and can devote several years to this huge operation undisturbed. A human healing art for the restoration to the normal state of those innumerable abnormal conditions so often produced by the allopathic non-healing art, there is not and cannot be." Well, the gist of this entire aphorism is homeopathy can claim to cure natural cases. It is beneficial in natural cases. Now, what is a natural case? The true, again, in aphorism number 78, he writes, "The true natural chronic diseases are those that arise from a chronic miasm, which, when left to themselves and unchecked by the employment of those remedies that are specific for them, always go on increasing and growing worse, notwithstanding the best mental and corporeal regimen, and torment the patient to the end of his life with ever aggravated sufferings. These are the most numerous and greatest scourges of the human race, for the most robust constitution, the best regulated mode of living, and the most vigorous energy of the vital force are insufficient for their eradication." So, Dr. Tim, please, I mean, do not glorify homeopathy to an extent that it can cure all cases. Cure, again, is a very relative word. An allopathic meaning, I mean, the meaning of cure in an allopathic sense or a modern medicine sense is different. And for homeopath, cure means complete extermination or eradication of the disease permanently. Whereas cure in modern medicine means only relief or extermination of that symptom proper, whether of whatever, or disease proper, what we are talking about. For example, if it's malaria, if the organism is gone from the body, then it is called as cured malaria. But in homeopathy, it is not so. So, cure is a very relative term. And yes, one should understand that cure is a procedural phenomenon. It takes, I mean, when we talk about curing a chronic case, it's a procedural phenomenon that follows certain laws. And one of the most famous laws in homeopathy is called Herring's laws of cure. So, the sickness to be cured needs to have an evolutionary pattern. If a sickness has an evolutionary pattern, for example, in childhood, I used to have recurrent nasal discharge or coryza and cold. I took a lot of medicines and suppressed it. Now I don't have nasal discharge and cold, but I have started having asthma. And after asthma, I have started having hypertension. So since asthma is 8 years old and hypertension is 2 years old, so this is called evolutionary pattern of diseases. From simple cold to asthma, from asthma it was suppressed and now I have got hypertension. Suppose if I have to treat it with hypertension, then the doctor, the homeopath would take my complete history, my mental makeup, my physical makeup, my constitutional makeup, my family history and past history, and give me a medicine which is called as a constitutional remedy. After a particular doses, then my hypertension will first be taken care of. Moment it is taken care of, my asthma will start exacerbating. In a few moments, I mean few months or days, asthma will increase. Then again it will go down. I will start having pharyngitis and sore throat and rhinitis. That means nasal discharge. So I have followed a procedure from hypertension back to asthma, from asthma back to nasal discharge. This is called as procedural phenomena or laws of cure. So, no, it is not possible for every single case to be cured with homeopathy, but definitely
We can palliate lots of cases, and of course we can cure natural cases.
Okay. Did you want to do more listener questions?
Yeah. Two more questions. Quite interesting questions, that's why I'm taking it. What is claudication? Dr. Siva Senanayake, I don't know whether I'm spelling it right, from Kandy, Sri Lanka. And the Kandy is spelled as K-A-N-D-Y, not C-A-N-D-Y. Dr. Siva Senanayake from Kandy, Sri Lanka writes, what is claudication? What homeopathic remedies can be administered for the same? Claudication, the literal meaning of claudication is limping. It is described as numbness, weakness, giving way, cramping, or pain in the muscle groups, generally the calves. It appears on exercise and is relieved by about 5 to 10 minutes of rest. It is an insensitive measure of peripheral vascular disease. Once a person gets claudication, repeated attacks of claudication, then the clinician, the homeopath, should think that the person is suffering from some peripheral vascular disease, possibly a blockage in the artery supplying the limb or vein supplying the limb. Symptomless diminished arterial flow is estimated to be 2 to 5 times common than claudication. I mean, when the arterial flow, for example, atherosclerosis occurs in the artery of the leg, it keeps on increasing and blocks the artery. Many patients are symptom-free. They don't get symptoms till very, very late. So it is much commoner, symptom-free patients are much more commoner. Atherosclerosis in the peripheral artery is a very silent disease as compared to that in the coronary disease where you can get angina or heart attacks. The medicines for claudication can be selected from the rubric cramps, legs, given in the chapter legs, page 1126 in the homeopathic medical repertory. It is also given in Ken's repertory in the page in the chapter of extremities, lower limbs. But the word claudication is not given. That's why I took the rubric from homeopathic medical repertory. There is a specific there are multiple drugs. One of the finest drugs available for claudication is cupramet metallicum, magnesium fos, you have got vipera, you have got crotalus horridus. These four drugs are really wonderful. Of course, any of these four drugs and other symptoms you can use for claudication. Should I move on to next?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Did you want me to ask you another question? I know that very often people think about cuprum for cramps in their legs, that it happens usually at night or... you listed quite a few. You listed cupra, magnesium fos, vipera, and crotalus.
Yep.
So there are quite a few that would deal with the... We see an outward cramp, but you're saying inwardly there's an arterial blockage.
Yeah, many times. I mean, peripheral arterial disease is a very slow and a silent disease. Till the artery is blocked, because artery has a very great diameter. The peripheral arteries have a very great diameter. So atherosclerosis keeps on progressing. And until very late, the patient gets symptoms. So claudication basically is a very late symptom.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And a rare drug called Hirudin, H-I-R-U-D-I-N. Hirudin prepared from the leech. I've
presented a few cases wherein we have angiographically treated patients. I mean, after the angiography, we found that it was 100% blocked. The external iliac arteries or the pudendal arteries or the popliteal artery, 3 to 4 cases I've got, and we have treated with Hirudin. We have given them in 6 and 30 potency every single day till we have noticed a significant reduction in the atherosclerotic plaque. So we have got angiographically proven records of these things. So it really acts.
I wonder how many people are using that.
Well, the thing is that many patients keep on going for angioplasty of the peripheral vessels. But if they don't want to undergo a peripheral, or they can't go for some other medical reasons, they can definitely try homeopathy, and homeopathy can deliver them sustained results also. The next question is from Dr. Bhuvnesh Dave from a place called Navi Anjar, Gujarat, India. And he asks, can the muscular development of an individual give a clue to underlying heart disease? Dr. Bhuvnesh, is this a clinical question or a question to test the author? Well, I had to actually read about this because even I did not know about this answer to this question. So, yes, Dr. Bhuvnesh, this is true more for infants and children rather than adults. Generalized muscular underdevelopment, I say underdevelopment, may be seen in patients having congenital heart diseases with left to right shunt, ventricular septal defect or an atrial septal defect or a patent ductus arteriosus. On the other hand, underdeveloped musculature of the legs associated with normal or overdevelopment of the thoracic and upper extremity muscles may be a clue to the presence of another congenital heart disease called coarctation of aorta. You have got...
Imagine a lycopodium person or lycopodium baby. Lycopodium baby have got thin extremities, particularly the legs, and a very well-built shoulder as well as the upper torso is quite well-built. But if it is there in a small child, then one should think of coarctation of aorta. And so to some extent, the muscular development can give a clue to underlying heart disease. It's not always true. It may or may not be true, generally. It is seen clinically. And the last question, before going on to my next thing, and that is breast muscles, is asked by Dr. Ganeshan from a place called Ooty, a hill station in Tamil Nadu, India, a very beautiful place, and especially this time of the year. And Dr. Ganeshan hails from Ooty, and he asks, sir, I have a case of 3-year-old male who has recently undergone 9 months of anti-COX. When I say anti-COX, it is anti-tubercular treatment for pulmonary tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is known by different names in India, and COX was the person who discovered the tubercle bacilli in India, and that is why we also call tuberculosis as COX, K-O-C-H, not C-O-C. It is K-O-C-H, COX. Now the child, he further asks the question, now the child has come to me with complaints of joint pains and swelling, which is aggravated by cold air and damp wet weather. The erythrocyte sedimentation rate, ESR, is 60 millimeters of mercury. The normal ESR in a 3-year-old child would be less than 10. The other investigations are within normal limits. Please guide me as to approach of this case. Very good question. A very clinically oriented question Dr. Ganeshan has asked me. A post-primary pulmonary tuberculosis, polyarthritis. That means after an attack of pulmonary tuberculosis, if you have got polyarthritis, then that disease is called as Poncet's disease, P-O-N-C-E-T-S, Poncet's disease, a very well-known clinical condition and specially seen in children rather than adults. The behavior of Poncet's disease is like rheumatic fever, migrating joint pains. It typically affects the large joints, and the favorite joints are the shoulders, the knees, the hips and the ankles. Rarely you can have finger joints involved and the elbow. So, but the arthralgia is very severe. The joint pain is very severe. So if the arthralgia is severe, then settle the patient by using short-acting drugs like Bryonia, Phytolaca, oxalic acid, and even you can go ahead to the extent of using high potencies, 10M, 50M, because they are very, very, very painful, and the child cries in agony once the joint pain starts. And or you can use some other drugs from a variety of rubrics like extremities, pain, stitching, joints, or extremities. Like in the Ken's repertoire, you can see in the chapter of extremities, you can see the chapter of pain, joints, fleeting, etc. So once you've settled the patient, it hardly takes 3-4 days or at the maximum one week to settle the child. And once the pain is bearable, then they take the complete history, the mental and physical genitals, past and family history, developmental history, because it is generally your case is a 3-year-old child, the milestones, the vaccinations. Please take the vaccinations details. You also should see whether bad effects of vaccinations were there. I mean, after vaccination, the entire symptom syndrome took place or not. possibly the child may have had BCG vaccination at the time of birth, but now,
the patient has had tuberculosis, and in addition would have been given a vaccination like a booster dose of tetanus toxoid or something like that. If it is there, then you have to
take this as an important point in the history. Also, you have to take the treatment history, the particular history, prescribe a dose of constitutional medicine on the basis of the presenting totality, follow up that patient, and this is how you handle the case effectively, whether it is a Ponce's disease case or whether it is tuberculosis case. It will be handled properly. It takes a lot of patience, it takes a lot of homework, it takes a lot of convincing for the doctor to convince the patients and the relatives so that they keep on taking homeopathic treatment, because seeing the agony of the patient, they easily can shift to steroids. In modern medicine, they would be giving steroids for this type of pain, but in homeopathy, we can still manage with I have only seen two cases of Ponce's disease till now, and I have managed them, one with calcarea fos and the other with oxalic acid. So, and both of them are still there with me. Of course, they don't take homeopathic treatment, they don't require it now, but still they are there with me. The families are still there with me, and they come often sometimes for minor complaints like acidity or something, but those two children are there with me till now. It's now 10 years and one is 8 years. So you can really effectively manage this case.
Would other people have such cases that you could gather more information?
Yeah, I believe because tuberculosis is a very common disorder, but now how many people actually know that there is something as post-tubercular arthralgia and Ponce's disease? It's, I mean, many homeopaths won't follow it. The problem with this is patients. Many patients, moment they get joint pains, they would directly go to a pediatrician, and the pediatrician would immediately start steroids and give NSAIDs. So if that happens, you don't come to know. And we don't come to know, you can't record such cases. So it becomes quite difficult. And another remedy which I've forgotten to mention is Pulsatilla. Pulsatilla can be thought of as the first remedy of choice, because you have a fleeting joint pain and a intense throbbing pain, and Pulsatilla has that type of symptom. So yes, if people are serious about this disease, then you can find such cases.
But so we think
on the whole, it is rare. On the whole, it is rare. I should admit that not many people, not many babies come up. But I have specifically seen in both the cases which I have seen, both had got history of vaccination and both I had to give Tuja.
So
apart from the constitutional remedies, I first started with those drugs. Because I remember why I was telling about vaccination, particularly the first case, one who was now 10, 11, 12 years old, I don't know exact age, but he had come to me with tuberculosis at the age of 2.5 years. And after the therapy, he was vaccinated with this booster dose of tetanus and diphtheria. And within a week, he started having joint pains. And they took out x-rays of his joints, knee joints, I remember, and those knee joints were normal. It was then that they gave me history of tuberculosis, and that was time we had treated him with first doses of, actually settled him with oxalic acid, and then Tuja, and then his constitutional remedy, calcarea fos. And it took me 8 months or 9 months, and from that time till today, he has not had a single episode. He's perfectly healthy.
And so it took 9 months to go through all of these. And how did you choose the oxalic acid, please?
Oxalic acid is a wonderful remedy for pain in the large joints, and the pain is excruciating pain, arthralgia, large joints. The pain is severe enough to make the joint hot, and it's a fleeting type of joint pain, particularly the hips and the knees. One of the finest remedies to think of. You have to give it in low potencies to start with, but if you're very sure about the drug, then you can ascend the potency.
Thank you.
So, finally, we shift on to our the breast masses, and the two breast masses, the two frequent breast masses. Of course, there are many more, which we did not speak about in the last show. It's breast abscess and fibroadenoma. Small review, breast anatomy, again a modified sweat gland, obviously present in the chest. The chest is also called in medical language as pectorum or the pectoral region, and it's functional during lactation. It should be functional during lactation. As far as the internal anatomy is concerned, it has the basic manufacturing, milk manufacturing unit, which is called the gland or the lobule, and the milk conducting unit, which is called as the ducts. All the ducts, they're called milk ducts. They finally converge onto the nipple, and the nipple is surrounded by small glands which secrete oil, which are called as glands of Rosenmüller, and they're very important. So this basically is structure of gland or the breast. And of course, as like any other tissue in the body, it is supported by fibrous tissue and fat. A lot of fat is there. It is drained by numerous blood vessels. And the main artery is called the internal mammary artery. The left internal mammary artery and the right internal mammary artery. The left internal mammary artery, LIMA, L-I-M-A, is a peculiar artery, which I forgot to mention about it. And we use that artery very, very often in coronary artery bypass grafting surgery, because it is one artery which, I don't know why, or nobody has been able to find out why, but it does not undergo atherosclerotic changes. So that is why the bypass graft remains patent. Anyway, so it is drained by multiple lymph nodes, and the different parts of the breast, the different quadrants of the breast, the breast is divided into four quadrants: the upper outer quadrant, the upper inner quadrant, the lower inner quadrant, and the lower outer quadrant. And all are drained by different groups of lymph nodes which are located in the axilla. So this is a small glimpse of the anatomy. And the various breast lumps, like our breast abscess, the cyst, the cancer, the radial scar, the fibroadenoma, breast lipoma, fibroma, hematoma, fibroadenolipoma, lymphoma, milk tumor, and fibroadenosis. All these are there, but they are quite rare as compared to breast abscess and breast fibroadenoma. So let us talk about breast abscess. Again, of course, with very good maternal care, this has become quite rare. And we don't see this entity often, but still, yes, it is there. In many gynecologic obstetrical hospitals, it was there. And abscess basically means a collection of pus. So if it happens in the breast, it is called as breast abscess. The commonest bacteria is generally a bacterial abscesses are generally caused by bacteria, and to a very, very lesser extent by fungus. It is not known that viruses or parasites cause breast abscess. So all in all, when we speak of breast abscess, we are talking about bacteria, and the commonest bacteria is Staphylococcus aureus. So how does it cause? The bacteria enters through a crack in the breast on the nipple. So the basic thing, the first thing which you require for a breast abscess is a crack or an entry point from where the bacteria can enter inside. It does not generally enter, it can enter via the nipple, which is the natural inlet and outlet, and or else the crack in the breast. It starts gathering in the fibrofatty tissue and causes pus, thereby mastitis. It invades the fatty tissue of the breast, so the abscess keeps on enlarging. There is a swelling or pressure on the milk duct, and causes abscess. The milk maybe, mixed with pus. It can be there. So this is how a breast abscess occurs. I have given you a picture on the PowerPoint presentation about breast abscess.
Right. So if anybody wants to see that, the PowerPoint is in last week's talk on Homeopathy World Community. If you look along the right-hand column, you'll see Dr. Adel's picture. Click it and you will find show number 44. Okay, so, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Common causes, how does this breast abscess occur? The skin of the nipples can crack, usually a result of baby's gums pinching the nipple.
Or else, sometimes the female can have diseases like, or very basically dry skin. There's a drug called Alumina in homeopathy. And Alumina constitution, females or females having an Alumina-like constitution typically have a dry, tetery skin. So particularly more so in winter, the skin becomes absolutely dry. So if a female conceives in winter, then as it is, the skin is dry. And if more so, if the baby is suckling less, then cracks develop. And they're very painful cracks. So usually, the baby is feeding and the baby's gums pinch the nipple, then also a crack can develop. The Staphylococcus aureus usually gets in the breast through cracks. Greater risk, the females with diabetes. Diabetic females are particularly risk with any infection, particularly so with breast abscess. Or those who have undergone nipple piercing or lumpectomies or breast irradiation for some reason or are using corticosteroids. For example, a female who has got rheumatoid arthritis or has got asthma, long-term asthma, and she becomes pregnant and delivers a baby. She's already on steroids post-pregnancy or even in between pregnancy. Then she has a very great chance of having developing breast abscess because corticosteroids decrease the immunity and they have a greater preponderance of infections. Any infection, but breast abscess, yes. Or females who have undergone silicone breast implants or are smokers. But females who have undergone silicone breast implants, they need not be feeding females. Silicone breast implants are applied once the breasts have been removed. And breasts are removed, mastectomy is done only in cases of cancer. But once after cancer, the patient has undergone a silicone breast implant, the borders, the implantation borders, at those sites, you can have breast abscess. And smoking females or smokers become pregnant, they deliver babies, they again have a very high chance of developing breast abscess. But problem is, once abscess is developed, fine. But diabetics, females on steroids, and those who have undergone silicone breast implants, their abscesses heal very slowly. It takes a long time for the abscesses to heal. That's particularly a tedious task, and therein homeopathy can help. How do you know that you have a breast abscess? How does a female know? And the first and the foremost, most important sign of any inflammation is pain. If you have a pain, if you have a painful lump, if the breast is enlarged only on one side, along with swelling, pain on touching, that is called tenderness, redness and heat, or if the nipple is discharging pus, frank pus, you can notice instead of milk you have a pus, or a nipple, a female who is feeding your child has a particular sensation of the nipple. If the sensation changes or she suddenly starts developing itching, and along with this you have got painful lymph nodes or painful swelling in the armpit of the same side, then you are probably having a breast abscess unless otherwise proved. Along with it, you can have loss of appetite. You can have fever, and the fever may be particularly high. That is, it may reach 103, 104 degrees Fahrenheit. The mother would be totally in a pathetic condition. So, breast abscess is a very painful condition. It brings on fever, and typically it takes about a week or more, a fortnight, to get it properly treated. So, how do you confirm it? I mean, it's very, very easy. It's clinically very easy to confirm breast abscess. You don't require actually any investigation. At the most, you can have blood counts, which are very high. Total leukocyte count, which is normal, is about 4,000 to 11,000. It may shoot up to 13,000 to 14,000. And it happens with all investigations, all infections. So, it's not new with breast abscess. If you still want to do, one may do mammography, but that is usually not the clinical practice because it's so obvious. It's so obvious to a clinician and even the patient that breast abscess occurred. so you can directly start with your therapy. Suppose if the female, by some pressure or by whatever, or some negligence, does not report to the doctor or is not taking any medications and just bearing the entire symptom syndrome, then she may be prone to develop fistula. Now, what do you mean by fistula? Fistula means abnormal openings. So that abscess, which is in the breast, apart from the nipple, may have another opening, another outlet. And it is the nature's method to get rid of the pus. So that is called fistula. And unfortunately, if the fistula develops, it does not heal promptly. So you can have fistula, and you cannot have only one. You can have multiple fistulas. I have given a picture of multiple fistulas opening in the PowerPoint presentation. So the breast abscess can be complicated with fistula. And one of the very, very important remedies to be thought of in such a condition is obviously silica. Silica in low potencies to be given, and it heals the condition. If not, then you can have necrosis and blackening of the skin, and that is gangrene. And it's a very bad situation, because then it may spread on to the entire bloodstream. The infection will spread on to the entire bloodstream, and you can have septicemia. Then you can have cellulitis. Cellulitis means the infection of the skin, and the entire skin is inflamed, becomes red, the entire breast, not only the skin above the abscess, but the entire breast. It may even spread to other parts of the skin, to other parts of the body, and you can have cellulitis. You can have extra mammary skin infection as well. So these are few of the complications, but most important complication is fistula. Then how do you prevent it? Before we talk of management, let us see how do you prevent it. Even if you feel that you have got this breast abscess, still continue breastfeeding. Infected milk will not harm the baby. And I repeat, continue breastfeeding. I know that it pains. I know the female has fever. But infected milk or the milk mixed with pus does not harm the baby. Bacteria in infected breast milk are killed in the baby's stomach. So basically not at all a problem for the baby. If breastfeeding is too painful, then you can use a breast pump to empty the milk from the infected breast, or you may use massaging, massage the breast. But massage with what? You can use ice massage rather than using heat. It is better to use ice massage. It may appear abnormal, but yes, it definitely corrects the condition faster than heat massage.
I'm very surprised. So you don't go into a warm bath?
No. It increases the inflammation, it increases the pain. Temporarily, it may relieve you for some time, heat. But the better massage is a ice massage, and it helps faster to heal the breast abscess, particularly the superficial breast abscess. So, if at all you want to massage, then you can do an ice massage. Well, which remedies? The first and foremost remedy which one would think about is obviously belladonna. And breast abscess is all the features of belladonna. That is, violent congestion at that particular place, high-grade fever, lethargy. And yes, so belladonna, if the patient is reported to you quite early, belladonna would solve the condition. You can use a potency as high as 1 mL, repeated every 3 hourly or 4 hourly. The symptomatology subsides. You can continue for 1 or 2 days. And if you feel that the remedy has done its work, the next drug is obviously Heparsulf. Again, a potency of 200 to 1 mL. And that solves your entire problem. It takes not more than 4 to 5 to 6 days at the max to take remedy. They are wonderful homeopathic antibiotics to call off, belladonna and Heparsulf. But that is in the early stage. If the patient has reported within 1 or 2 or maximum 3 days, once the patient, she has felt that it is probably a case of breast abscess. But suppose if she has reported late, then what do you do? If she has reported late, then you can use directly with Heparsulf. But if Hipparself is not showing results in one or two days, it takes only maximum 2 days to know whether your remedy is actually showing results or not. You don't have to wait for weeks together. So if Hipparself is not showing results in 1 or 2 days, then you can use Cystis Scan.
Okay. And how do we choose that one?
Next dose, the Cystis Scan would be a very lumpy feeling in the breast. Lumps are there. The lump may become hard. The lump is very painful. And the fever is still there. And you know it's a breast abscess. It's not something, and it's not malignancy. Because malignancies are painless. Malignancies of the breast are basically very painless. So Cystis Scan can be a second remedy. And it really helps using this. Suppose if you have got pus the milk is mixed with pus, and along with it you have got pain and all, then you can directly use lactofluoratum.
Lactofluoratum for which one?
The milk is mixed with pus.
Okay.
If you have a yellowish colored, quite a deep yellow colored milk, and if you don't want to feed the child such a milk, and still you have a feeling of, all the features of breast abscess, you may not go in for Hipparself, you may not go in for Belladonna, you may directly start with lactofluoratum in low potencies, 30 at the max 200, repeat it often, and in 2 or 3 days, the milk would come, return to its original color, and all the symptoms will subside.
Where were you when everybody needed you? I don't know.
I'm still here. And these all are not my personal experiences only. They come to, from a very small age, I've been seeing my mother treating such cases. So they have actually become, I don't need to remember those things. I've seen them act in the hospital. So this is breast abscess. Lastly, suppose if the female is very unlucky and if the breast abscess has burst out and she has got, it's called septicemia, then it's wiser to hospitalize the patient, stop the feeding because the female requires nutrition herself. She should not nourish the child. And first thing you start with is directly with pyrogenum. Pyrogen should be started if it's available in millisimal scale, 0 by 1, 0 by 2, 0 by 3. You can start any of these potencies. If not, then you can start with at least 1 mg potency. Repeat it thrice a day and you can decrease the septicemic state. Of course, extremely rare, very, very rare. I have not seen any case of breast abscess turning to septicemia. But if at all it happens, then you have to use pyrogen.
Okay.
Then we come to another most common, more commoner than any of, or other of all breast masses, the most common is fibroadenoma. The safest is fibroadenoma, and it's actually the proliferation of stromal or the glandular elements. Either it can be both. The fibrous element can be enlarged, or the gland can be enlarged, or the combination of the both. So it's proliferation. It's generally seen only in the reproductive age groups, starting from puberty to menopause. And it does not change. The size of the mass does not change during the menstrual cycle. But it regresses at menopause. So either generally it is a single lump. And rarely there may be more than one or two lumps in one or both the breasts. Again, single lump, single breast is the rule, rather than an exception. But rarely you may get two or three lumps in a single breast and one or two lumps in both the breasts. The biggest thing it is also called as the breast mouse, because it's easily movable under the skin. It is firm. It is painless. It has a typical rubbery consistency with smooth and well-defined borders. And you can actually feel the entire mass. You can put it in your finger and you can feel it is very soft. It may grow in size during pregnancy, not necessary, but may grow, especially during the 8th month of intrauterine life, when the baby is the female is in the 8th month. That is the time when the fibroadenoma particularly slightly grows in size, or rarely it may become slightly painful, but other than that it remains slow and steady. Or if the female is taking hormone replacement therapy, she is perimenopausal or menopausal and she's put on hormone replacement therapy, at that time fibroadenoma can suddenly grow in size. I have given a diagram, a picture of fibroadenoma. So how do you know it's a fibroadenoma? It's a painless lump, a thickening in the breast. Sometimes you've got, just a minute, sorry. Sometimes, very rarely again, you may have a nipple discharge, which is very serious in nature, watery in nature. Very rarely it may turn to breast cancer. How do you know it? By a breast ultrasonography or a mammogram, very, very easily. Basically, it's a clinical diagnosis, but still if you have to prove it's not a breast cancer, you may at the most do a breast ultrasound.
Did you say it's rarely a fibroadenoma will rarely become a cancer? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I repeat it again. It's rarely that it may come to become a breast cancer. It may stay in for years together in the female, and cause no harm. So the entire apprehension that a mass in the breast is there, it has to be removed, do a surgery, it may turn to cancerous state. No. It's quite rare that it turns. It may, but it requires a family history to do so. It requires an emotional insult and many things to precede this fibroadenoma to be converted to a breast cancer. But then, it is not so much clinically often seen. But unfortunately, my fellow colleagues would not have any lump in the breast and they would prefer to take the breast off, or at least take off the lump and keep it, send it for histopathology. Of course, I don't advocate, but then it's a debate between the two parties.
I often see, if you go for the walk in the woods, you see trees that are very ancient and old, and they have cancer growth on their trunk, and they're still flourishing. They have green leaves and flowers, and even with these types of growths on them. So is that possible for humans as well?
See, basically, when we talk about pathologies, a cancerous or non-cancerous pathology, it is actually any pathology is the attempt of the body to get rid of the miasmatic load. It is throwing off the entire sickness in the form of a lump, or rather caging it. Focusing it only on one point, and at that point the disease is limited, the entire constitution is healthy. So this is one way of looking to a fibroadenoma or any malignancy. If you see malignancy only, it becomes a very dangerous situation. But if you see that the entire body is actually taking care of itself by limiting the pathology to one small organ or one small swelling or one small mass, and that is the way of shedding its miasmatic load. That is how Hahnemann has taught us to look into pathologies. How Kent has taught us to see pathologies. It is the nature's method or the constitutional method to limit its disease. If we tamper with those methods, then there's a likely, the great chance that we actually spreading the disease. If we tamper with fever, because fever is body's response, pain is body's response to a particular stimuli. If we tamper with that, keep on tampering, then we have to bear the consequence. Same way with malignancies also. If we keep on tampering with those masses, knowing not what they signify for that particular individual, then yes, that entire growth will spread. So anyway, if you have a breast mass, it's always, the female has some sort of apprehension, and yes, it's always the cancer that comes first, irrespective of how mobile the mass is. The female always thinks that I have got cancer. Anyway, How do we manage
yes,
the homeopathy?
And,
yeah.
and we have so many people go year after year to have any kind of cyst or anything removed, anything that looks perhaps to the doctor suspicious. People today, Miss Universe or one of these high-profile celebrities as having a double mastectomy. She wasn't even diagnosed with cancer, but just because it is hereditary, then the fear is so great that they remove body part. I don't understand it, but this is the way it's done today.
Yeah, it's a sad way of... I always explain to my patients that if you had no doctors, wild animals don't have doctors, but still they survive. They are very healthy. The nature, if it brings on a particular disease, it is taking care of itself. We don't know the language of nature. So why should we be gods? Everything, we can't have a blanket prescription for any and everything. We have to be very individualistic. And that is the beauty of homeopathy. Be individualistic. See how this constitution has reacted. And why homeopathy? It should be a universal truth for medicine. Be individualistic. Don't give blanket prescriptions. Don't generalize things. Every individual is unique. It has to be taken care of. Every pathology is unique. And it has to be taken, respected. That because nature has brought it. Human man, the man has not brought it himself. The woman has not brought it herself. It is the nature which has brought it. So first ask before tampering with it, should I do what nature or the... So this is a holistic understanding of a fibroadenoma. It's the nature's attempt to throw off miasmatic... When I keep on uttering this word miasm, miasm is a bad force. It's a diseased force. There's a vital force which infuses life and another diseased force which makes the vital force sick. So when the vital force gets rid of this miasm, it encompasses, or it is one of the one form is this fibroadenoma. Well, I cannot go much into miasmatic theory. Let us shift on to management. How do we manage this breast mass? Well, the first thing which I do is I would give a start with a nosode, and the commonest nosode I would start with is either Thuya or Medorhinum. How do I decide of these two nosodes? Number one, if the patient is extremely chilly, then intolerant to cold at all, then it is Thuya. If the patient is very hot, then my drug would be Medorhinum. A single dose would be given, 1 mg, one dose, that's it. After that, I'll give the constitutional remedy to the patient. And after the constitutional remedy, after the single dose, I'll wait for a week and then shift on. If the mass is rubbery in consistency, my drug would be Lapis Alb, L-A-P-I-S, Lapis Alb, album. I would give in very low potency, at the most 1 cc or 2 cc or 3 cc, repeat it and slowly see the mass size decreasing. After 2 or 3 months or 4 or 5 months, if I feel fit, again I repeat the constitutional remedy with a single dose and ascend the potency of Lapis Alb. If it's in rubbery consistency. If it's hard consistency, the second drug would be, the next drug would be Cystoscan. Hard. Still harder, Phytolaca. I would hesitate to use drugs like Conium or Iodum too often, repeated potencies. Phytolaca, being a smaller remedy, a lesser proofed remedy, does the job. Phytolaca is the finest remedy for fibroadenoma breast, and we have so many cases. And my mom was telling me the other day, we have so many cases wherein phytolaca, simple use of phytolaca, has actually decreased. And we have got scan reports, evidence-based homeopathy, what you call regression of breast masses with fibroadenoma, phytolaca. So phytolaca is, but phytolaca growths are typical firm to hard, movable growths, not responding to Cystoscan, then I would choose Phytolaca. So that is
now,
how.
Now, are
I would
you giving
manage.
Are you giving Phytolaca as a mother tincture, as a low?
Yeah, it is better to give. Better to give, because you have to keep on repeating often. It's much better to give it mother tincture form, so you don't cause proving of the drug. You have to give in very low potency, definitely less than 30 potency, either 1, 2, 3 or 6 at the most. So that proving is not, because you have to keep on repeating. They are pathological remedies. And the constitutional remedy has already been given. But constitutional remedy will basically stop the tendency for malignancy or tendency for this growth formation. But what we are actually aiming is the actual growth should also get reduced. Then we have got this drug. Suppose in spite of Phytolaca, after giving 3-4 months of Phytolaca, nothing happens. Then what do you do? Then we have got another remedy, a very good remedy, thiocyanamam. Thiocyanamam, a very, very good remedy given decimal scale, 1x, 2x or 3x, again for 2 or 3 months. If Phytolaca does not respond, then thiocyanamam will. So these are all we have. Homeopathic armamentarium is very big, very effective. So dear ladies and gentlemen, please take help of homeopathy in breast masses. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Okay, so do you want to update us about the calendar schedule of when you will be able to continue on? Because we're coming, this is the last month of 2012. We've covered a lot of material, and due to holiday schedules and birthdays and whatnot, we skip some of the weeks.
Yeah, because on 12-12-12-12-12, my son was born. 12-12-12, and then he was born on 12-12.
Okay.
So, I don't want to miss his birthday this time at least, because it's only one in his lifetime, in our lifetime, that this date is going to come, and he wants me to be there in the evening party. And so that's why we skip 12th and we directly go on 19th. And from 20th or 21st onwards, I will be teaching the postgraduate school on homeopathy. So I'll be busy till 30th. So we meet definitely next year. Continue with the eruptions rubric of chess chapter.
So you will have to investigate December 12, 2012, all of the possibilities for something good to happen in your son's life, in your life, the family, for it to have been on this year and this occasion.
Yeah, I mean, we have been thinking about this date for a long time, and we always feel very happy. How come, I mean, 12, 12, 12, we don't get, I mean, my daughter is 26-9, so she can never get, or even 19-9, I can never get such figures. Only he's lucky to have 12-12-12. So yes, we would celebrate, and
there are many world events. 12 is the energy of creativity, artistic beauty, harmony, and celebration. So that's what you're going to do.
Exactly.
And so I wish you well. I'm going to continue on to do a reading, a little bit of a reading today from Herbert Roberts. I've been going through all of the chapters from what homeopathy can offer to humanity, to physicians, and to those people who are interested in healing. And we learned about the vital force and how it expresses itself. We discussed Herring's Law and Direction of Cure and how they act. Taking the case was the last thing in analysis of the case. So we're up to the Law of Cure. So
Well, all the very best.
Thank you so much.
And I have to be off. Actually, I cannot go home. I'm busy. I've been called for another patient in the ICU. Let's see what happens. Good night.
Okay. Good night now. Take care. And so for all of those who are listening in, we're going to be continuing on with the study with the Principles of Art and Cure by Homeopathy by Herbert A. Roberts, M.D. This is chapter number 10, The Law of Cure. And he says, all natural forces are based upon law. These laws do not operate in a limited field, but are universal. To illustrate, he gives us the law of gravitation is not limited in its scope to the earth, but its influence extends throughout the universe. And even in today's talk by Dr. Adel, he was talking about nature and how nature throws off the miasmatic, the hereditary tendencies in certain symptoms, such as these breast fibroadenomas, the lumps that we have in the body. And I also explained that trees, plants have the same type of enclosure, encasement of a disease, and they still go on to live long lives. So, and also Dr. Herbert Roberts talked to us about Herring's law of cure, that everything is from within out. Hahnemann, by his fine observation and the inductive method of reasoning, became convinced of the law of cure, which we call similia similibus curentur in Latin, and embraced it and declared it to be universal, a basic law of therapeutics. And that's what we base homeopathy upon. If there is any general law of cure, that law must express some relationship between the medicine and the disease. To be of any practical use, such a relationship must be exhibited, and we must be able to demonstrate such a relationship between a disease and its remedy that any examination of the former shall determine the latter. So you're going to see the connection between the disease and the remedy. Nothing can be known of the disease save through the phenomena known as symptoms. These are evident to our observation and senses and must be recognized. These phenomena represent the individuality of the disease in the only way in which we can recognize it. A corresponding capability exists in the drug of producing an individual, though artificial, disease, which we recognize through the same method of observing the phenomena produced after the administration of the drug. The power to produce these phenomena is what we call the properties of the drug. So in the same way that the only way that we can sense that you're not well, that you're you have a disorder, a disease in your body, is through the symptoms that are observable by the viewer or by the self. We notice we don't feel well. How do we describe those symptoms? And in the same way, the drug, when given to a healthy individual, will produce symptoms. And that's how we understand how the medicine acts. It is the characteristic of disease to produce certain phenomena. He's calling these symptoms or symptom picture or group of symptoms, he's calling them phenomena, which are not observable in perfect health. This is true whether the changes are functional or structural. So previously he's discussed functional, meaning this is the time that homeopathy can really act, and when you have a structural change, that is a pathology. What we recognize as symptoms are all that can be known of the disease. It is only through the observation of these expressions that we can make any use of the law of cure, and there can be no general consideration of the rule of cure unless it comprises a consideration of symptoms as one of the necessary elements. You've got to look at these symptoms in order to know the direction of the cure. He explained earlier in the talk today that if a child starts off with a cold and that turns into asthma and then it turns in later in life to hypertensive high blood pressure, you're seeing the evolution of the disease. In the same way, we're going to see this in the way the medicine acts and in the law of cure for the symptoms that are what he calls the phenomena. One might say that a comprehension of the symptoms of a given case was one of the primary factors. And in so far as one comprehends the expression of disease in these phenomena, is one equipped to follow the law of cure in any particular case? So you've got to follow these laws of cure, which is what he's telling us. And that takes a lot of education and experience and learning and listening, observation of the patient. Symptoms are the only representative expression of the disease state. So he's really putting a lot of his money on the symptoms that we can observe. We include sensations as expressed by the patient, the appearances in all parts of the body, the varied circumstances under which these symptoms were recorded, and the varied grouping of these symptoms in any consideration of the case. So just as Dr. Adel said, he answered my question about the fibroadenoma, will it ever turn into a cancer? He said this is rare, but then he added, in the case of some sort of a trigger, whether it would be environmental or emotional or an injury or something, this would then perhaps turn this adenoma into from a functional disease to a structural disease of cancer. And Dr. Herbert Roberts says that he includes the sensations of the expressed by the patient. So if the patient says that it feels hot, it feels swollen, it feels like pressure, whatever they say, this is included in the observations of symptoms that are recorded, and varied groupings of these symptoms in any consideration of the case. When a symptom is noted under certain circumstances and not under others, this obvious relation between the symptom and its related circumstance is in itself a symptom, or rather, a part of the symptom, the sensation being quite incomplete without the expressed relationship of circumstance. Very often, the concomitant of circumstance is of greater importance to the whole case than the expressed sensation. But sensation is much more frequently expressed by the patient. So what he's telling us is very often people will say, this migraine, it feels like a nail sticking in the top of my head. It feels like such and such. And the sensations, as if you can look up in, he's talking about his book that's called Sensations as If, a Repertory of Subjective Symptoms. And also Dr. Adel said that Timothy Allen also wrote a book on sensations. And what he's telling us here is a concomitant is much more important than just saying, I feel like I've got a cold coming on, or it feels fuzzy, or I feel my brain is foggy. You know, these kind of things, what you look for are a concomitant. So when a person says, I feel this way when I also feel this other thing, those two points on the scale will be much more important in the case taking. Two or more symptoms may appear together or synchronous with each other, he says, so frequently that they are really one symptom. Aha! And must be considered as such in our analysis. So when a patient says, I feel giving an example is, I feel sore whenever I move this way. So what is it? The concomitant is moving in such a way brings on this soreness, and it is considered as one symptom, as nothing in nature can be represented by a single property. So no disease can be represented by a single symptom. So you can't just use one keynote or one symptom as the point that tells you what remedy to give. In fact, we usually use a triad, a triangle to pinpoint most things in nature. A law of cure must represent some relation between the properties of the disease and the medicinal qualities of the drug. Or in other words, we must have some concept of the character of the drug's action on the living body that will interpret the law of cure in the action of disease. So we must know the drug's action in order to know how it will act curatively in a disease. This character of the drug is represented not by a single effect, by a group of effects. This group of effects is the only representation we have or can have of the medicinal character of a drug on the living body. And since these same effects are found in disease states, these effects are the only relationship that can be established between the medicinal effects of the drug and disease. And highlighted here, he says, there can be no law of cure unless it expresses some definite relation between these two groups or classes. The homeopathic law establishes a definite relation, not only between proved drugs and known diseases, but between all the unexplored medical wealth and the underdeveloped requirements of sickness. Like the law of gravitation or gravity, the law of cure, as taught by Hahnemann, is not and cannot be limited to a small group of conditions. The limitations rest entirely with our ignorance. It means that if we are missing information or do not recognize something or do not acknowledge something based on our ignorance, we are missing the law of cure, the relationships, the homeopathic laws that establish these definite relationships between the drugs and the disease. And we must extend our medical knowledge about sickness. Hahnemann and his followers constitute the only group of medical philosophers who have always been true to the inductive method of reasoning. And by scientifically following this method of reasoning based upon known facts, they have established this law of therapeutics. It has been proven by experience that a medicine will remove a group of symptoms similar to the group which it is capable of producing. This law, founded upon observation of facts, meaning this is a scientific endeavor. Homeopathy is science. It's based on facts. It's based on universal laws, has been the product of inductive reasoning and has been proven by years of experience to be true and sure. So anyone who says that homeopathy is not a true medical science is incorrect. No medicine can cure any disease unless it acts upon all the diseased parts, either directly or indirectly. The more similar the symptoms of a drug resemblance to the disease, the nearer is its vital approach to the disease, and the more dynamic its action. So you're going to see if you're on target and hit the mark as to the drug effects and the symptoms of the disease, you're going to see its action more dynamically. The number of parts of the human body susceptible of receiving the curative action of drugs vastly outnumbers those recognized in the anatomy, because disease and cure do not lie in the tissues except as a reflection of the man him or herself. This we may see from the most infinite diversity of symptoms producible and curable by drugs. There is an almost infinite number of parts or in each organ, and this vast number are suffering together, some more or some less. The affection of each element may be different from that of any other. The aggregate affection composing the disease of that tissue of that one organ. How much more complicated is the disease of the whole body, even though that manifestation may be classed as a local disease. One organ cannot suffer alone any more than one cell can suffer by itself. Every disease affects in some way or to some degree every organ, every tissue, every molecule. And this is something that homeopaths recognize, that we're taking the totality, we're taking the case of the whole case, that if one part of the body is affected, the entire body is affected. Disease is systemic. Disease is throughout mind, body, and spirit. What we see is the tip of the iceberg. What we see, those sensations that the person elicits and the physical symptoms that we see, or even the clinical lab reports that determine something has changed in the blood, all of these are just indications of something much greater, much deeper, from the spiritual essence of the individual, the vital force, whether the vital force is weakened or strengthened, and why they are susceptible to this composition, this aggregate of disease symptoms. And that's what he's talking about, looking at the concomitants and what are the relationships between the drug and the symptoms they can elicit and the disease, what the disease symptoms can elicit. Because of custom, we express ourselves in this sense as from the greater toward the smaller, from within, from without, inward. Yet, an analytical study must remind us that the disease manifestation is an exfoliation, an outward manifestation of an inward turmoil. That is not found in the most minute examination known to man of any cell or portion of the human frame. We may find disease manifestations, but we cannot find disease itself. So even when a person says in a sensation, I feel such and such a way, this is a manifestation of the disease, yet we will never actually find the disease itself. We're listening and observing the outward expression of the disease, which is found only in the inner turmoil. No medicine can effect a perfect cure unless it has a curative action upon every diseased part. And in just the proportion that each part manifests disorder. Potentized medicine, that's homeopathic medicine, administered according to the law of similia of the likes cures likes, is the true regulator of the vital energy. That vital essence, which is synonymous, or at least analogous, to the man or woman, him or herself, and lies very close to life itself. The totality of any disease is the totality of the morbid action, the sensations and manifestations. Any true and complete and comprehensive law of therapeutics must recognize all the morbid phenomena and show some relation between them and the curative agent. This relationship must be direct and clear. Jocelyn says the degrees of conceivable relationship between the action of drugs and that of disease may be represented by an immense circle. So these are like Venn diagrams, if you remember your mathematics in middle school or high school, I don't know, junior high, wherever you were in school. Identity is the central point, and on this point stands isopathy. So that is treating with the exact same disease or drug. So that is a little bit different from homeopathy. Immediately around it are arranged the most perfect degrees of similarity. This is the province of homeopathy, the similimum. Contiguous to this is the ring of similarities, less perfect, but still great. And again, Dr. Otto, in his discussion today about breast abnormalities, breast abscesses, breast tissue, and fibroadenoma, said you begin with such and such a remedy, whether it is silica or belladonna or heparsulf, and if the disease has moved further and has not been affected by these remedies, then you need to look into the next set of remedies. So in other words, the ones that you first try that are not working completely are less similar. So if you try the silica and it is not working, it is not similar at all. If it's doing a little bit, then it is somewhat similar. But if it is not curative, then it is not exactly in the center of the circle, or on these outer homeopathic rings of similimum. This field is the field of the near similar, but not the similimum. Isopathy, he says, is not homeopathy. We must keep this distinction ever before us. Isopathy is identity. Homeopathy rests its whole case on the similarity, and in the degree of its perfection, we may be sure of the results. We cannot be accused of combating symptoms. Rather, we are guided by symptoms in combating disease. And I'm going to repeat that one. We cannot be accused of combating symptoms. Rather, we are guided by symptoms in combating disease. And as he said, disease is really unseen. We're only looking at the manifestations in the symptoms. The law of cure, similia similibus curantur, is a fundamental as any law in nature. It is a law of universal adaptability to human sickness. It ranks in the field of astronomy. This is the only general law for the cure of the physical and mental ills of humankind. It is the only method of healing that depends as a whole upon one general principle, and it is the only method of healing that has continued to withstand the pressure of time and changing circumstances. It is a law of nature discovered by following the thread of inductive reasoning and proven to be true by countless tests. We need Dr. Herbert Roberts to be out there today talking to new physicians, to experienced physicians, to teach them all of these wonders that and principles of laws of nature, because today medicine has gone awry. A lot of it is failing as they are so dependent upon laboratory exams, upon x-rays, upon mammograms, upon MRIs, upon all of these things that are not observable by the eye, by the sense of smell, by the sense of touch, but are looking deeper into the organs, into the cells, into the DNA. And yes, we are getting educated. We are getting knowledgeable. We are learning more to build up our information about sickness and disease. But does it follow the fundamental laws of nature? That is our question that I will leave you with. Dr. Roberts says, what is the most hope we can hope to know of disease? That is his question to you and me. What can we hope to know of disease? Did you get the answer in today's talk? What can we know of drug action? What part does observation play in homeopathic prescribing? We know in the past, homeopaths are just like Sherlock Holmes. We are looking at the cues and clues given by the patient and in our knowledge of the disease. What kind of symptoms are most frequently voiced by the patient? So the answer to that question is, they usually talk about their sensations. That's what they say, I feel this way and thus. And this is important in the case taking as well as what you observe. When you observe hot, red, swelling lump, those are facts. But we also need to take into consideration how the patient feels about that. Are they anxious? Are they not even responding to the pain? What is it the patient feeling in each individual case? What are concomitant symptoms and how do you rank them as to their relative value? We see concomitant symptoms are, he explains them as they're one. When they come together, then it becomes one symptom, but it is vitally important. It is a key symptom to note in that individual. Why do we say that the homeopathic law establishes a definite relation between drugs and disease? What does this mean? The homeopathic law of similia similibus curantur, the similars, the fundamental law of nature. because the relationship of the drug and the disease must come close in order to be curative in action. If the disease produces certain symptoms, the drug must produce the similar symptoms in order for it to be curative. What are disease manifestations? The disease manifestations are what we observe, are they not? And we don't really know the disease itself wholly and completely in its spiritual essence. We only know what we see in the material world and what we hear from the sensations from the emotional world and the mental world. What is the difference between isopathy and homeopathy? Based on Jocelyn, we see that isopathy is the exact same, the center of that concentric circle, whereas homeopathy are rings around isopathy. So it runs circles around isopathy, you might say. And so that is the end of today's reading, today's chapter. And I want to just let you know the other things that you might find on Homeopathy World Community and what is upcoming. We have a talk on Monday on the Health In Show. That's Monday at 11 on nissancommunications.com, The Health In, with Dr. Robert Bruck, environmental expert on global climate change, and he's going to talk about what's happening currently and health effects. We just had a report this week about the very high emissions, carbon emissions, into our environment, and what is that? How is that going to affect the planet? Following that, we're going to have Dr. Isaac Golden talking about homeoprophylaxis or anything new we want to ask him about, and that will be the 17th of December. So first is the December 10th and then December 17th on the Health In Show. On each Wednesday, we do have this show with Dr. Otto. We've been covering a lot of questions from callers, from people who contact him through his website at homeoacad.org, and go there. He's going to be giving a big workshop, a seminar, and so let me look that up for you, and I'll let you know if you're interested in participating in this event. Right now, it is going to be on, and so he won't be with us on the show, but I might continue with some repeats of older shows. The classes about homeoacad.org is December 21 through December 30th, 2012. It is the National Academy of Homeopathy in India, the 21st Residential Homeopathic PG Winter School on the Principles and Practice of Homeopathy. They're going to be having Shad Yoga, well-designed exercise, it must be yoga, an exercise schedule for an hour to help the participants to nurture spiritual virtues and combat the mental and physical stresses. There will be a live case presentation, analysis and discussion, audiovisual demonstrations of model cases, taking procedures, case types, miasmatic evolution, repertorization and plan of management, approach for the second prescription, and follow-up schedule. There will be applied philosophy, the doctrines of idiopathogenesis, living hexity, evolution of sickness and disease, eliminations, ultimates, and end results, concomitants, suppression, palliation and cure, susceptibility and resistance, defense systems, miasma, rational management, human mind and psychosomiasis, live materia medica, clinical examinations, practical repertorizations, drug potencies, selections, and much more in terms of lectures. So this is going to be intense study for 9 days. If you want to learn about it, go to homeoacad.org to find out more and sign up. Besides that, I will let you know that there's going to also be a online course by Dr. Dinesh Shawan, and you have to go to his website also, which is www.casewitnessing.com, resources, courses, and you're going to find the basic online course in case witnessing protocol. And this basic course brings forth the opportunity for you to learn the basic and vital features of the case witnessing process from your own desk, from your office, from your, I don't know if you can do it on your mobile device, but that would be interesting. It's an online teaching session with Dr. Shawan, and you'll be able to see the recordings, the live video cases, the PowerPoint presentations. You'll be able to ask your questions and share your views. Enrollment is starting now. The class starts in January 2013. There will be a new session beginning each month, January, February, and March. So for those people who like to learn about that method of case taking, that is available. I also want you to take a look. We had a session last Monday with Miranda Castro, well-known homeopath, lecturer, author, and she has for us some treats, some gifts from her web shop. So go to Homeopathy World Community and click on that link that says Special Miranda Castro Discount Code HWB12 until the end of this year and get a discount on any of your cell salt purchases, book purchases, or kits. And listen to her talk. We had a lot of fun talking about cell salts on Monday. Tomorrow we're going to have Alan Phillips talking about vaccinations and your rights in the United States. And he usually gets 1,000 listeners to his show or archive listeners. And they are very enlightening and informative if you want to know the legalities of vaccinations and all about current events, what's happening in your neighborhood, your state, your nation, and how to get active, because that's really the point of the show, that we do not live in a bubble and we must work together. We are partners in this effort of creating waves of awareness. We need for you to be active, just like people were active for the California vote for getting GMOs labeled. You know, it's really something strange in the United States that these huge corporate forces have so much power that we are not being given our full rights in America. And we're going to have to fight for them, folks. In order to do that, you have to be educated. And so that is Alan Phillips, Vaccinations and Your Rights in the United States, Thursday at noon on this channel, Blog Talk Radio. Please share it, tweet it, Facebook it, stumble upon, Reddit, dig it, whatever you do, let other people know what's happening. We have also some awesome articles on Homeopathy World Community. We have case studies that are quite thorough and explicit by many of our homeopathic practitioners on the website, by Amit Karkari. We have a case of autism, Learn from Your Failures, from Dr. Navneet Badani. We have an attempt to solve the controversies in homeopathic prophylaxis, written by Dr. Mohammed Rafiq. We have the stories from Anna Vervaeche, and she is on a walk across the country to talk to people, to stops along the way and tell them about homeopathy, answering questions, taking live cases. And she has been giving us notes about this time in her life, celebrating her 60th year. What about Graviola soursop remedy? People have been talking about it all across the internet. This particular fruit, tropical fruit, has medicinal properties. Everybody says it's good for cancer. Well, is it really? Take a look at the facts and make sure that when you click that reply or forward or when you tweet a button, whatever it is, when you repeat something that somebody else says, if it is a hoax, if it is an urban legend, you really need to stop it in its tracks and give the facts. So check. When something doesn't sound real, then you need to have a critical eye about what it is it's being sent and being said, and please do due diligence by investigating. We have a lot of other forums on Homeopathy World Community. We have an awesome collection of tips by Dr. Dushyant Kamal Dari from India, and he is really into plants. He's an incredible photographer and talks to us about little hints and tips that he learned. What about Osmium Sanctum, the holy basil herb? It is well known and well used across the globe. And how can you take a look at this medicine and herb? What about Cucurma longa, the cucurmin plant, and its benefits for cancer? Can we just take it into our diet in the form of a fruit, a vegetable, an herb? How do we use these spices? So we have so much to learn from each other. I hope that you will get onto the network, onto Homeopathy World Community. If you are just a layperson interested in homeopathy, we only allow professional, trained, experienced homeopaths to become members and post onto the network, but anybody can get onto Homeopathy World Community on the Facebook channel, and we welcome your comments, your questions, your inquiries. If you have anything that you would like us to be doing on the shows on Blog Talk Radio or on the Health Inn, you have a suggestion for a guest, let us know. If you have questions for Dr. Otto, he will be pleased to answer them live on air. If you want your case taken, you can speak with Dr. Otto. You can speak to my co-host, Dr. Deepak Sharma from the Orbitz Clinic, and he is also taking cases. So we have so much to share. I'm going to end today's show and see you tomorrow at noon. Take care, everyone. Sending waves of awareness, lots of love, and good thoughts and intentions.
Thank you for listening to Heart Health and Homeopathy on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We encourage you to follow our show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when the show airs, and share with friends on Facebook and Twitter. Please send in your comments and questions, and we'll see you next time.